Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu Madhittishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Supreme Lord protect both the teacher and the student, and may He cherish and nourish us both. May we work with full energy, may our study be perfect, and may it give us good results. May we never feel ill will towards others.
Okay, so yesterday, we were on our second day of exploring the demon within us. And one of the difficulties that comes when we start to be introspective and self-analytical is that we run the risk of falling prey to inverted pride, which means that we do the opposite of being proud, but it's just as bad. Now, we develop a sense of low esteem or inability to cope with the anattas that are there. They feel, sometimes when we have a good look inside, we get a little overwhelmed by what we see. So Ananda brought a very, very nice quote by Marianne Williamson, which has a lot of food for thought in it. I'd like to share it with you. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, and fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. Therefore, nothing enlightened about shrinking. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people don't feel insecure around you. You're born to make manifest the glory of God that is within you. It is not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we're liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. So very much, it reminds me as I'm reading it, I'm remembering many Bhagavad Gita slokas actually, especially in terms of our fear of personalism, transcendental personalism. It's one of the greatest and subtlest challenges we have to face as devotees. It's one of the reasons we stay so external. We're fearful of giving up the externals and exploring the reality. So I thought to thank you very much for that. Do you mind if I hold on to it? It's very, very nice. Very nice. So today we will explore the last section of chapter 16. In previous verses in this chapter, Krishna has clearly and very succinctly described the demoniac from many angles of vision. He's really given us a very holistic understanding of what a demon is. And in verses 19 and 20 of today's verses, he describes the way he reciprocates with these people. Let's have a look at this. This is verses 19 and 20 of the verses we'll be looking at today. Those who are envious and mischievous, who are the lowest among men, are perpetually cast in the ocean of material existence, into various demoniac species of life. Attending repeated birth amongst the species of demoniac life, O son of Kunti, such persons can never approach me. Gradually they sink down to the most abominable type of existence. So usually when we think of Krishna, and the way we are encouraged to think of Krishna, in fact, is that he's merciful, that he is very, very merciful. But here we find that he's talking like a thunderbolt. So I was interested to read Baladeva Vibhushan's commentary on these verses. He actually has a conversation between Arjuna and Krishna, where Arjuna is trying to act as an intermediary and trying to implore Krishna, you know, give these guys a break, you know, give them a little mercy. But the result of his attempts is quite fascinating. This is actually recorded in Burujan Prabhu's Surrenderant to Me. If you'd like to have a look at it another time, it's on page 314. So this is Baladev Vijaybhushan commentary on verse 20. Arjuna asked, but after many lifetimes, they should eventually get your mercy by which they'll be freed from their demoniac births. Lord Krishna answers, these foolish persons take birth in demoniac forms of life, birth after birth. Failing to achieve me, they descend to lower forms of life, even taking birth as dogs. In the phrase, failing to achieve me, the word eva certainly indicates there is no possibility of my mercy falling upon them. It is even difficult for them to achieve a good form of life that would be a natural prerequisite for attaining me. The following question can then be raised, but the Supreme Lord automatically, he can fulfill every desire. He can make even the unqualified qualified. And the answer is, yes, he could if he had such a desire, but actually he does not even have a seed of such a desire. It's quite heavy. So we get the idea that Krishna is not very impressed with these demoniac people. But the stronger understanding that we have is that there's never a reason. We know in our own lives that when we get a good slap or a good kick, there's good reason for it. So then it made me think, well then, why? Why is he so heavy in his dealings with the demoniac? I'd like to hear what you think. Why? Why is he like this? How could this heaviness be a benediction from him or protection from him? Krishna Priya. But is that usually the way we think of a highly elevated person, eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth? You know, there must be something a little deeper for him to be God and be acting the way he is. Otherwise, it's just a low class person on the street that, you know, you hit me, I hit you back. You know, there must be something that's a little bit different here in the way he's doing things. Can anybody, I know it's Friday and it's been a tough week, but try and push a little bit. Yeah, Leela. That's an interesting point, that the person is so covered that the only way that they can possibly be awakened from that ignorance is through a little bit of suffering. That's an interesting point. Nari. Yeah, that's something that Prabhupada says in his purport, that even the lowest of the low, by the mercy of the devotee, the bona fide devotee, can take to Krishna consciousness. Analakshita? Very nice point. That the demon is very inimical in his attitude towards Krishna's devotees. And Krishna doesn't like this. So I was thinking also along that line that he's not only a disturbance, the demon is not only a disturbance to the devotees, but Krishna's mission also. So then, you know, it's better for them and better for the mission and better for the devotees if they're out of the way. So we see that I think most of us have had experience of this. Let me know if you have or haven't. But I've had experience of when I've acted improperly, my facility to do things is minimized. Like Krishna restricts your field of activity when you do something that is not proper. I remember talking to a sannyasi who fell down, and he was explaining to me his experience of fall down and how Krishna interacted with him. And he went from being someone who had unlimited facility, you know, like in many, many ways, unlimited facility, because he was doing Krishna's work. But then he had a bit of a slip, and Krishna immediately withdrew it. And he said that it shook him up so much that he could actually understand. He realized that he'd fallen into the bewilderment of pride, which is typical of the demoniac condition. But this shaking by Krishna, of restricting the field of activity, woke him up. And he could understand, actually, you know, that he'd borrowed a few feathers, but he was actually quite insignificant. Like that. Have you had that experience where you've felt some extra mercy and then there's been some abuse of it? Krishna or the person who's given it to you has withdrawn it, and then your field is reduced and you wake up. Have you ever experienced that? A few nods of heads. You have to be sensitive to the energies and what's happening to to wake up to what's happening here. But it is one of the more subtle ways that Krishna deals with our anattas. Ananda. Yeah, this is a very nice point. The idea that Ananda's making the point that our understanding of what is a person is a little disjointed at this point in time. We don't really have any understanding of what a transcendental personality is. And to deny them emotions like anger for particular reasons, or this kind of thinking even, is to deny their personality. I remember that, I think it's Baladev Vijayabhushan commenting on Krishna's reaction to those who call him formless. He has no arms, he has no legs. He gets really angry with them. I'm a person. I have arms, I have legs, I have eyes. And so I can very much appreciate the point you're making. And this is one of the biggest stumbling blocks for us as we start to move into the more subtle areas of the anattas, is that because of our attachment to matter, which is impersonal by its nature, and because of our ideological base, the societal background we're coming from, we have a tendency to be impersonal when we look at the root of things. It's just part of our makeup. And then when we start to think personal, we start to think romantic idea of personal rather than transcendence. And even when we get to the point of talking transcendental personality, there's a big difference between Vaikuntha personality and Golok personality. Anyone who's aspiring for Golok, you really do, the heart has to become as fluid as a fish. Otherwise, no go. If you want to keep that little bit of hardness of heart, you'll do fine in Vaikuntha, because everything's very clear, black, white, God, me. You know, it's all very, very clear, and you know, the whole mood is paying respects, is how you show your love. But in, you know, like, you know, Ramachandra Puri, if we think, I don't know about you, but if you think about your emotional response when you read that Leela in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's not very pleasant, is it? You think, yeah. How do you feel when you read about Ramachandra Puri? Are you impressed with him as a person? Are you? No. He, you know, like his critical fault-finding mentality. But Ramachandra Puri is Jatila in Braj Leela. So, you know, the spiritual world is made up of such an amazing variety of personalities, and it's all for the taste of Krishna. And that's why we borrow from the impersonalistic path the idea of equivision, coming to the point where we can understand that everyone and everything is part and parcel of Krishna. Because from that platform we can start to understand spiritual variety. If we can understand and we can tolerate people that don't have the same values as us, same moods as us, start to broaden our base a little bit, it's actually an entrance into higher realms. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you. So I appreciate those points that have been made, and I think particularly in relation to this section of Bhagavad Gita, the main concern is that Krishna, you know, if a child, regardless of what you say, will put its hand in fire, you know, then you're going to restrict its access to fire, isn't it? So here, Krishna is restricting their field of activity and protecting them from further degradation. Once they hit animal species, they're no longer able to accrue their own karma. They're under cosmic law. So they're a little bit protected, and they're not a disturbance to others. I wanted to read you something that Prabhupada said that I found quite interesting on this. It's from Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 5th chapter, verse 38. Actually, it's from the purport. Demons like Jamaraj and other controllers are there for the unwanted conditioned souls who are always engaged in threatening the tranquility of the kingdom of God. Since all the demigods are confidential devotee servitors of the Lord, they are never to be condemned. Under the regulative principles of the Supreme, Such mischievous persons are thrown into the darkest region of material existence and are born of asuras or atheists. Birth after birth, such asuras go still further down, finally to animal forms like those of tigers or similar ferocious beasts. Thus, for millions of years, they have to remain in darkness without knowledge of Krishna. What kind of people get this birth? One who blasphemes the Lord is put into a family of asuras, in which there is every chance of forgetting the service of the Lord. So we're looking at quite a heavy aspect of Krishna's personality and Krishna's dealings. Sometimes he does show his mercy by directly killing the demon, and in that way the demon will attain liberation. Prabhupada mentions this in his purport to verse 20. In verse 21, Krishna clearly explains what will take us to such a hellish existence. And he advises us very strongly to give up these activities and, you know, act sanely. This is a very famous verse from Bhagavad Gita. And it's the beginning. It tells us the beginning of demoniac life. There are three gates leading to this hell: lust, anger, and greed. Every sane man should give these up, for they lead to the degradation of the soul. It's important to understand when we read this verse that the central quality that causes disturbance and which acts as a pivot for all other negative qualities, the destructive qualities, is lust. We've already come across this in earlier chapters. Anger and greed are actually secondary and dependent on this lust. In fact, Prabhupada makes clear in the purport that all demoniac qualities are rooted in this lust. So how is that? Can anyone think of how that is? It can explain what we're talking about here. How is it that lust is the root of all demoniac qualities? Nice answer. That it's a perversion of pure love of Krishna. It's the crystallizing agent that brings us down into the material world, covers our consciousness. Yeah, right. Very good. Yeah, I was also thinking about that. That it's a fact that when we our lust is frustrated, we don't get what we want, then the natural response is frustration. And the result of frustration, of course, is anger. They're very closely aligned. And then even if we do get what we want, because of the nature of material desire, we're not satisfied, we want more. So then the greed will increase. So then we get back to the formula Krishna gives in 270, better you don't try and fulfill these desires, but you try and tolerate them and develop spiritual desires that will create the kind of greed that is useful. Greed for Krishna, greed for pure transcendental association, greed for the qualities that will allow you entrance into a high grade association, and anger. It will create anger. You know, why can't I give up these crazy anattas? You know, so then it becomes very positive energy. It'll propel you in your spiritual life. So also this greed, Prabhupada explains, it gives birth to illusion, and there's a lack of discrimination arises. When we're very, very greedy, we become bewildered and we really can't discriminate from a objective point of view. We become preoccupied with this thing or person we want, you know, to the point that we can no longer discriminate objectively. And from this comes a very deep-rooted bewilderment of pride, that, you know, controllership, and wanting, we start to try and make plans to try and control the environment, trying to control those around the environment so that we can get what we want. And then when we combine all five of these, the result is envy. So we've got that on the board here, that lust, anger, and greed come from these. These two combine give birth to a deeper illusion than we're usually in, which gives birth to a bewilderment of pride and controllership. And then when you wrap these all up in a parcel, the result is envy. So it's quite a heavy and very vicious chain that we step into when we let our desires run away with us. Yeah. It means that we don't listen. People can tell us, people from all directions can tell us what you're doing is crazy, it's going to give you problems. No, I know what I'm doing. I am in control. I know what I want. Get out of my way. This is a mentality, bewilderment of pride. We all suffer from it. We've all had experiences when we've done this. As we go on in devotional life, it may be a little bit more subtled and more subtle. We may not say things so harshly. We may tell people sweetly, or we may even avoid speaking to them. But still, the same tendency is there. And it's the cause, the root cause of our difficulty. Yeah, what means around is that all five of these in the middle here, when you wrap them up into a big parcel, the end result is envy. This is what we end up with. It's a manifestation of the primary root of the problem, which Lily was talking about, is that we're here because of our love for Krishna has been perverted into a self, desire to self and joy. Mm. Very good point. That's a very nice point. Bettina's saying, does that mean if we want to get rid of qualities like anger or pride, that we should be looking at the essence of the thing, which is lust? That's a very good understanding. That's a little bit deep. And of course, the way we get rid of lust in a very proactive way is to become very conscious and attentive in our devotional practices. Because the more we fill our lives and our consciousness with Krishna consciousness, which is the real love, then the less we'll have time to be preoccupied with these negative side of things. Yeah, that's a good understanding. Yeah. Yeah, it manifests most dramatically in sex life, but it's certainly not what it's about. It's not all that it's about. It's just a culmination of how it usually manifests. I remember Bhavananda Prabhu. It was very interesting. It was ironic, actually. He gave a brilliant lecture where he explained fall down, and he was explaining that when we become preoccupied with the subtleties of sex, the profit, adoration and distinction, and we become preoccupied with them to the point that we start chasing them, and then they'll have us chase them out of the crowd into a lonely place, and then they'll turn around in the form of the opposite sex and embrace us. It's really heavy. Very powerful. So that's one aspect of it, is the external manifestation in terms of sex life. But what we're really looking at is a very fundamental problem, is that we have a desire to enjoy matter, and we have a desire to enjoy it separate from Krishna. Basically, what we remember when we did the mirror example? So someone who is, they may be a very highly refined and cultured person, but for as long as they're facing the mirror and trying to interact for their own benefit and satisfaction with the mirror, they're lusty. And then when we start to try and turn our back to the mirror, not in the sense of not trying to utilize it in Krishna's service, but trying to get away from that mentality that this is for my enjoyment, everything is for Krishna's enjoyment, then that state we're starting to, the lust is becoming less. Like that. So definitely we're not talking only sex. We're talking any tendency to enjoy separate from Krishna. And if you need a middle road as a next step, that's a very high goal, to try and do things in nothing independent from the desire of Krishna. But there is a middle road which is given in Nectar of Instruction, which you're studying now. And that is to be aware that there is a direct line between the mouth, the belly and the genital. So if we are controlling the mouth in terms of what comes in and what goes out, then there won't be problems with the rest of the line. So if it's a little bit beyond us at this point in time to try and handle it from the point of view of trying to not do anything that is independent of Krishna's desire, at least the next step up from, you know, gross sex attraction is to try and, you know, put a stop to things by using this formula given in NOI. And it works. If you're very, very strict in your eating habits, you're only taking prasad, and you're trying to curb tendency to speak nonsense, speak critically of the devotees, trying to develop positive qualities of speech, gentleness of speech. All of these qualities, we're reading in the fourth verse, all of these qualities, you know, we're not only talking activity, but we're also talking mood and speech. So when we were talking in the fourth verse, about pride, arrogance, conceit, anger, harshness. So these qualities, if they manifest in our speech also, this is something that's very, very difficult to give up. So when you're angry, rightfully angry with someone, to speak gently. It actually is very, very powerful. If you can be very together, you have a good right to be angry, you need to chastise someone, but you do it in a proper way, in a way that is not manifesting qualities of the demoniac and the ignorant, it can be very, very powerful. It can actually change somebody's heart. I've had personal experience of that, that instead of reacting as most people react, you know, you do it according to Gita, it impresses, and it changes the heart, which is the whole function of chastisement, isn't it? It is to change the heart. Not to degrade or belittle. Okay, so Krishna's he's wanting us to give all of these up, and he's given us very good reasons to do that. And in the 22nd verse, this is interesting the way Krishna works. He always gives a negative. If you do like this, this will happen, it'll be terrible. And then in a couple of verses later, the next verse, he'll say, but if you do it the right way, there'll be such a wonderful result. Instead of, like, you know, always giving the negative and the positive. In any circumstances, it's a nice preaching technique and counseling technique. So in verse 22, he's saying, the man who has escaped these three gates of hell, O son of Kunti, performs acts conducive to self-realization and thus gradually attains the supreme destination. So Srila Prabhupada, in his pulpit on this verse, he describes how giving up lust, anger and greed will yield this result. We'll read it. A little bit of the purport, just to get a feel for this. Starting from the beginning of it. One should be very careful of these three enemies to human life, lust, anger, and greed. The more a person is freed from lust, anger, and greed, the more his existence becomes pure. Then he can follow the rules and regulations enjoined in the Vedic literature. By following the regular principles of human life, one gradually raises himself to the platform of spiritual realization. If one is so fortunate by such practice to rise to the platform of Krishna consciousness, then success is guaranteed for him. In the Vedic literature, the ways of action and reaction are prescribed to enable one to come to the stage of purification. The whole method is based on giving up lust, anger, or lust, greed, and anger. So we can understand from this that it's a scientific formula that Krishna is talking here. That if we can somehow or other deal with these nasty monsters, and it will take practice, there will be mistakes, but if we can practice trying to deal with these personalities in a proper way, then we'll find that our existence will become purified, will be more peaceful, there'll be less... I noticed yesterday when we did that little look at demoniac qualities, most devotees, one of the three was anxiety. Very, very common. But if you can just try and deal with these three and in your life and in your consciousness, then you'll find that things become a little bit more settled. Mode of goodness is by nature more settled. There's not these stresses that come with the lower modes. And then when the existence is a little more pure, you get a taste for it. You like to live like this. And the resentment and the challenging mentality goes, because both of these, resentment is a reflection of ignorance, and the challenging mentality is passion. So when these start to go, then you start to think, not a bad idea that I follow this book. You know, this book is pretty far out. Maybe I should live by this book. So it's a natural result of trying to give up these three enemies. The existence becomes a little purified. Then we, you know, start to think about things in a clearer light, understand that the Vedic scripture is the best way to live. We do it. And then we can understand, yeah, Krishna is God. Better I do it His way. And then we're home and host. Then we've made it. We can live in this world without fear of fall down, because we're attracted and absorbed in Krishna. We don't see His energy anymore as separate from Him. We don't see ourselves anymore as separate from Him. And then life is different than what we're experiencing now, for the better. Okay. So, Krishna starts to really drive this point home, actually. This idea that he does it in both verse 23 and 24, that trying to live our lives independent of Shastra is a really terrible idea. It's really not a good idea. If you value your sanity, you have any love for yourself, you should follow the Shastra. So in 23, he gives us a negative side. It's pretty heavy. He says, "He who discards scriptural injunctions and acts according to his own whims attains neither perfection, nor happiness, nor the supreme destination." So this is, Prabhupada explains the significance of the word kamakarata in his purport. He tells us that a person who knowingly violates the Shastric rules acts in lust. He knows that this is forbidden, but still he acts. This is called acting whimsically. Such persons are destined to be condemned by the Supreme Lord. So this is a nice answer, very practical answer to Amrit's question, actually. To act knowing the Shastra, but you violate it knowingly, that is to act in lust. You know it's forbidden, but still you do it. That is lust. In this purport, Prabhupada also explains the connection between not following Shastra and acting in lust, anger, and greed. Maybe Tapaswini, would you like to come out and read this?
No problem, it's Friday. Just a section.
This is text 23, just the beginning. Do you want me to read the verse? Yeah. "He who discards scriptural injunctions and acts according to his own whims attains neither perfection nor happiness nor the supreme destination. As described before, the Shastri Vidhi, or the direction of the Shastra, is given to the different castes and orders of human society. Everyone is expected to follow these rules and regulations. If one does not follow them and acts whimsically, according to his lust, greed and desire, then he never will be perfect in this life. In other words, a man may theoretically know all these things, but if he does not apply them in his own life, then he is to be known as the lowest of mankind. In the human form of life, a living entity is expected to be sane and to follow the regulations given for elevating his life to the highest platform. But if he does not follow them, then he degrades himself. But even if he follows the rules and regulations and moral principles and ultimately does not come to the stage of understanding the Supreme Lord, then all his knowledge becomes spoiled. And even if he accepts the existence of God, if he does not engage himself in the service of the Lord, his attempts are spoiled. Therefore, one should gradually raise himself to the platform of Krishna consciousness and devotional service. It is then and there that he can attain the highest perfectional stage, not otherwise."
That was hard.
So here is there's a saying, proof of the pudding is in the eating, isn't it? So here in the 15th chapter, Krishna is giving us information to bring us to the position of understanding that he is God. chapter is called Purushottam Yoga. He is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And now he's starting to explain what will practically show whether we're prepared to accept that or not accept it. We can dress as devotees, we can wear our tilak in the best possible way, we can wear the biggest net beads in the group, no problem. Huh? But that's not what counts. Krishna is saying whether you're a demon or you're a devotee depends on whether you are following Shastra or not following Shastra. This is the bottom line. And Prabhupada is really, really stressing this point. So it's some food for thought. He further elaborated on this actually in a Bombay lecture he gave in 72. I'd like to share that with you as well. Anyone who does not care for the instruction given in the Shastras, just like anyone who doesn't care for the law of the state, what kind of man he is? He's a loafer, an outlaw. He's not a respectable citizen. Similarly, anyone who does not follow the Shastra, Shastras are meant for human beings, not for cats and dogs and hogs, as law is meant for the human beings, not for cats and dogs. Therefore, we have to follow the Shastric injunction. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, or Vyasadeva says in the Puranas, in the Vedanta Sutra, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Anadi Bahi Mukta Jiva Krishna Buli Gela, Ataiva Krishna Veda Purana Karila. What for these Vedas and Puranas are meant? Because we have forgotten Krishna. We have forgotten Krishna. Therefore, to revive our Krishna consciousness, so many Vedic literatures are there. So Shastra Shakshushat, everything we have to take from the Shastra, because we are blind now. Shastra Shakshushat. Our, the Shastra Gyan, because the spiritual master enlightens the disciple with Shastra Gyan, therefore he is spiritual master. If the spiritual master bluffs to the disciple, then he is not spiritual master. Bluffing. No. Agyanatimarendasya. This is Guru. Guru means he'll always enlighten the disciple with the light of Shastra. Not that he will say, no need for Shastra. I am incarnation. Whatever I speak, you take it. No. This is rascal. You should immediately, who has no reference to the Shastra, immediately take him as rascal number one. This is the conclusion. So we can get some hints here from what Prabhupada is saying, that our position on Vedic injunction or Shastric injunction is very different than that of the materialistic religions. For them, it's basically ensuring that they keep the piety checklist higher than the impiety, that they're not a disturbance to society. But with us, with the devotional injunctions, Shastric injunctions are given in the Vedic literature, especially in terms of Shastra like Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavatam, Nectar of Devotion, the whole purpose is to re-establish us in our constitutional position. In Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami uses the example of the child learning to walk. He talks about Vaidhi Bhakti, the rules and regulations of sadhana bhakti, as being like the child trying to walk with the help of the parents. So the child inherently is able to walk. He's been born with legs, you know. He has the desire to move around like mum and dad. The inherent ability to walk is there, but still he has to learn to walk. Still he has to fall, get up, walk a few steps more each day, fall after a longer period of time. So that is like, for us, sadhana bhakti. The purpose is not just rules and regulations. The purpose is to bring us to the point where we can not only stand and walk, we can run. Huh? We are by nature transcendental personalities. We belong to a different realm than we're living in. So we have to start to make connection. We have to start to, you know, slowly, slowly wake up to who we really are, where we really belong. So for us, rules and regulations have a whole different we have a whole different understanding of them than the materialistic religions, whereas if, you know, you do the right thing, you go to heaven. If you do the wrong thing, you go to hell. It's not like that for us. For us, it's a matter of reinstituting ourselves in our spiritual, our transcendental position. So it's a good point to remember. You know, we're not rules and regulation wallers. You know, they have a purpose. They're a tool. That's their only function, is they're a tool. We should remember that in dealing with ourselves and dealing with others. That, you know, like, and if we see that something will be a disturbance to someone's consciousness or the activity, what they need at this point in time to further themselves, then we maybe have to adjust things a little. Of course, we can't adjust the primary principles. They're given by the Acharya. But we may have to be mature in our application of the principles in devotional service. Otherwise, we can be more of a disturbance than a help in our preaching and our counseling. Okay. In verse 24, Krishna is basically acting as our well-wisher and giving us some pretty solid advice. Here he is saying one should not therefore understand what is duty and what is not duty by the regulations of the scriptures. Knowing such rules and regulations, one should act so that he may gradually be elevated. So he's basically saying that in your decision of what to do and not to do, what to do and not to do, make that in light of Shastra. And then things will be a lot more in tune with Krishna's desires and therefore a lot more peaceful and successful. We read a little bit of the purport. We'll start two lines down. If one understands Krishna from the Bhagavad Gita and becomes situated in Krishna consciousness, engaging himself in devotional service, he has reached the highest perfection of knowledge offered by the Vedic literature. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu made this process very easy. He asked people simply to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and to engage in the devotional service of the Lord and eat the remnants of foodstuff offered to the deity. One who is directly engaged in all these devotional activities is to be understood as having studied all Vedic literature. He has come to the conclusion perfectly. Now we can understand from this that we're not talking intellectual conclusion. We're talking a level of realization. For someone to do this consistently and in proper consciousness, taking prasadam, taking only prasadam, chanting the holy name, taking only prasadam, engaging in activities, devotional activities, to be constantly doing that means that we've accepted, yes, Krishna is God and I'm his servant. So we're not talking intellectual understanding, we're talking realization here. Okay, I have quite a few things I'd like to do today, so perhaps we'll stop here. It reminds me of when you read like these benedictions given by Prabhupada, you know, it's so simple for the simple, isn't it? It's so simple for the simple. But to come to the point of having that faith in Prabhupada's words, lack of faith means doubt. Doubt means dirt. So if we're still in a position of we really, in our heart of hearts, we still don't trust that Prabhupada knows what he's talking about, you know, then we can understand there's still some more work to do in terms of cleaning up our act. But it is amazing, the benedictions Prabhupada gives in his teachings. Even though we're so unqualified, he's giving us all facility to attain the highest just by following his instructions. It goes against the grain, because usually when we think of achievement, we think of endeavor, self-endeavor, I will achieve. We see that amongst the so-called rusics in ISKCON, very, very concerned to, you know, they know the language, they know the books, but they haven't got the basic principle, faith and chastity to Guru. So, you know, for all the language and all the books, what's it going to achieve? It's a mental platform. I remember Bhakti Trimaraj, he told me, there's a Bengali term for this mentality actually, it's called Manabhav, Shastric term. And the result of this, if you're meditating on the pastimes of Krishna and you don't have the purity of heart to do that, then it's a material activity. So you may spend your whole life absorbed in the writings of the Acharyas, like this That may be your bhajan. But you'll come back next life as some village woman in a, you know, some part of UP or something, carrying a water pot on your head. You won't enter Golok. Because the consciousness has to be pure. So we should be... there are certain problems with not being faithful to Guru. Any questions on anything I've said in class today? Yeah. No, definitely not. Actually, Prabhupada made that very clear, that those who are actually following Christ are saintly people. Because Christ, Prabhupada said that he came... I've heard two versions of it. He has called him a Vaikuntha man, whether that means he came from Vaikuntha or not. But I also heard, I haven't got the reference for it, from it, but I heard from Harikeshwami that he came from Janaloka, and that the only suffering that is felt at that level of heavenly planets, because they say going back to heaven, so they mean Janaloka, and that the only suffering that is felt by these people, they have all the cities, and which mean he could walk on water and, you know, get lots of fish and loaves up. But the other thing is that the only pain, the only distress they feel is compassion. These people from the very high levels of material planets. So they're certainly not demons, but they're misguided. They're misguided. Well, if the thing is, Prabhupada, from his conversations with Christians, you can understand this, that the thing is that if they are following the teachings of Christ as he gave them, then they're to be considered saintly. They're following Shastra. It's not that the Christian Shastra is not bona fide. It has a certain, because there are different levels of consciousness, so Christ, you know, is a manifestation of a certain aspect that is needed for that kind of barbarian, you know. It's not, you know, if you compare the Ten Commandments to what's given in Bhagavatam, then you can understand that it's a difference of audience. It's not that one is bad and one is good. Both are good for who you're giving the medicine to. Like when you're talking Ten Commandments, you're talking, you know, like people that have to be told don't sleep with another man's wife and don't kill animals and eat them. Don't kill other people also. This low consciousness, you actually have to instruct them that way. But then when we open up to the pages of Bhagavatam, you know, for a start, you know, you've got all these self-realized, a lot of them, many of them, self-realized souls sitting down to, you know, for quite a few thousand years, they want to hear Shastra. I mean, what is the comparison and level of consciousness? But it's very important that we understand it's not that one is good and one is bad, but rather they're different levels of the same thing. Krishna will come in all sorts of ways to deal with all sorts of levels of consciousness. We can see that in the Puranas. You know, there are different Puranas that will be of assistance to people, mainly in the modes of ignorance, mainly in the mode of passion, goodness, and then transcendence. So Krishna is happy because he's not envious of us. He sees us all as his children, so he will make facility. And Christianity is one of those facilities. But unfortunately, it was polluted by Constantine. When he, you know, like he had a lot of things changed in Christ's teachings to facilitate his conquering of, you know, different aspects of what he wanted as his empire, you know. But if you look at the Red Sea Scrolls and things like that, you get a clearer idea of the actual root of those teachings. They're pretty far out, you know. There's vegetarianism was there, idea of incarnation was there, transmigration was there. But then for political reasons, that all got sort of outlawed. So, is it okay? So, you know, that kind of person, there's a big difference between that kind of Christian and the New Age born-again Christians, you know. The born-again to be gone, born-again, born-again, born-again ones. So, any other questions before we move on? Yeah. Yeah, this is a good point. We'll be looking at in the 17th chapter that according to the modes that govern us, we will be happy and peaceful with a certain kind of worship, a certain kind of faith. Religion will attract us. It's all based on the modes that govern us. So, you know, if someone is practicing Christianity and their more mode of goodness, then they'll surely, more than likely, bump into a devotee. More than likely. You know, they have some contact. You know, my mother's a Christian, but, you know, she's a Catholic. But she loves Hare Krishna Prasad. She goes regularly, you know, she's good friends with the devotees, and she's got her own Bible and all that kind of thing. But, you know, she's very fond of the devotees, and she loves Prabhupada. She's very, very attached to Prabhupada. She never read his books, but she likes to see the videos. He's such a nice man. And she takes prasad, takes her friends there, like that. So, you know, no problem, no harm. Any other questions? Okay, so what I wanted to do, yesterday we had a look at the demon in us. We're going to have another look today in a slightly different way. Today I'd like you to take a, and I'd like to look at, if we get time, I'm hoping we'll get time to have a look, bit more of a look at what we did yesterday as well. But time seems to run away. I want you just for today's exercise, just to take a clean sheet of paper and give it three headings. Three headings. First one will be willfully. That means you do something, you thought about it, you know what you're supposed to do, and you decide you're not going to do it anyway. And then whimsically. Oh, I can't be bothered today. And the third heading is chastely, with chastity, meaning abiding by the Shastra. But please don't take this seriously. I'm just trying to give you... I don't take it too much to heart, in other words. Take it seriously, but don't be too disturbed by the results. So we have just done... yeah. Okay, so most of us have just finished studying Nectar of Devotion. So... our study of the Nectar of Devotion is primarily, because it's the eastern wave of the Nectar of Devotion, is primarily concerned with sadhana bhakti, vaidhi bhakti in fact, and looking at the 64 angas, or limbs of devotional service. Rupa Goswami has given us these 64 items of devotional service so that all of our activities of speech, mind, and body can be practically engaged in Krishna consciousness. Okay? And in that way, we're always under the shot of the internal potency, under the shot of Srimati Radharani's lotus feet, and we're protected from the material energy. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just read through some of these, and I want you to be honest with yourself. I'm not going to collect these papers. This is just for you. I want you just to tick whether you're following it chastely, the item chastely, means you're doing it as a regulative principle in your life. Whether it's willfully not doing it, you have some misgiving, you don't like this one, so you don't do it. Or you're doing it whimsically, as the mood moves you, you do or you don't do. Okay, it'll be an interesting exercise. Yeah. Willfully not doing it. Like, you know that that's the injunction, but you don't like it, so you don't do it. Okay. What's that? Oh, whimsically is a different thing. There, it's not so much that you don't like it, is that maybe today you can't be bothered. You know, it's more like... Pardon? Whimsically. Whimsically means according to my whim. Like, today I'm in a good mood, so I'll do it. And today, tomorrow I'm in a terrible mood, so I can't be bothered. I'm not just not going to do it. You know? Who's this guy that calls himself God anyway? You know, like that. So let's have a try. Any more questions before we start? Yeah, you sure now? You think we need a fourth category? Okay. That's a good refinement, actually. Yeah. No, I like that. That's a very good refinement because, especially as we get older, and not even, it's not always a matter of age, sometimes it's just a matter we've got, you know, it's pretty hard to pay your advances when you've got malaria and typhoid together, you know. So I've had that together. So, you know, we put here inability. What do you call it? Inability. We know what we mean by that. It's not that we're using excuses, but we actually have a legitimate reason for not doing it. That's a very good one. Thank you very much for that. Pardon? 59 will start. Okay. First one, accepting the shelter of a bona fide spiritual master. You may have diksha, but are you accepting the shelter?
There are subtleties to this. You need some other categories.
Okay. Accepting initiation from the spiritual master and receiving instructions from him.
Just try it on your own for now. We'll talk about it a little bit later.
Serving the spiritual master with faith and confidence. Following in the footsteps of saintly persons.
Put the tick in the right place. Don't just pull faces. Put the tick where it is. It'll be useful for you for introspection.
No, just ticking.
Okay. Inquiring about eternal religious principles.
If you're in this class, I'd say you were. Being prepared to give up everything material for Krishna's satisfaction. These are regulative principles. That means for everybody in time, place and circumstance. These are not detail. These are principles of devotional life. Residing in a sacred place. That doesn't mean only dham, but also temple. Accepting only what is necessary. Observing fasting on Ekadasi?
Fasting from
pain. Yeah. Prabhupada's standing. Offering respect to sacred trees, like Tulsi Devi, banyan tree, Amlaki. Giving up the company of non-devotees. Straightforwardness in ordinary dealings and equilibrium. Straightforwardness in ordinary dealings. That's one. Equilibrium in loss and gain. Respect for the demigods. Not giving pain to any living entity. Not blaspheming or criticizing the Lord or his devotees. Reciting notable prayers to the deities. Or at home, reciting notable prayers. Okay, so I've given you 20 items. I wanted you to count up the number in each column and just write it down at the bottom of the column. You only have 17? Okay, so I'll give you 3 more to make it an even number. Circumambulating the temple. Yeah. Bowing down in front of the deity. When you enter the presence of the deity, bowing down. And wearing tilak and tulsi beads. Okay, so that's 20 now. Okay, so count them up in the 4 columns and then we'll just have a look at numbers, not at weaknesses. Important thing to remember when we do these little soft exploration exercises, in particular this kind of thing, is that the primary difference between the demoniac and the devotee, according to Krishna, the Acharyas, and Srila Prabhupada, is whether or not we follow Shastra. Externals may be there, but this is the bottom line. Yeah. That's a matter, actually, the question was that I marked many of these as inability. But then, what is the real understanding? Is it actually inability, or is it willfully not following? This is something that we as individuals have to work out. That's not something for somebody outside, unless they're very much in tune with you as a person and very sensitive to your needs. Usually it would be something that you have to introspect on yourself, unless there's somebody very qualified and very sensitive to your nature and needs. Can get from the outside. It's not something you could do in a class, but it is something that we really, really have to look at. I can't remember the name of a woman, maybe somebody here knows, but there's a very interesting book printed by a woman who's into subtle energy, and she looks at all of the ailments of the body in terms of emotions. And it's very, very interesting. In fact, I found it so useful that it was one of my primary tools in dealing with my brahmacharis when I had a preaching team. Like, very interesting things. Like, yeah, what's the name of the book? Do you remember?
Small book,
right? Yeah, like a paperback. Yeah. Yeah, it's very, very interesting. For example, if there's congestion of the chest, like constant problems with the throat, like that, it's because you've got something on your mind that you really want to say, but you don't feel you're in a circumstance. The position is not such that you can actually speak your mind. Either it won't be appreciated by other people, or you feel insecure to say what you really think, like that. Trouble with your knees, time for a few humility lessons. You need to come down a little bit in your estimation of who you are. It's a very interesting book. But so, you know, you may find these kind of books a useful tool in exploring, you know, because we all have to deal with a subtle body, which is, you know, looking at things from many lifetimes before. It's a pretty complex mess. So sometimes these tools can be useful, just in sort of checking out, you know, what's in the subconscious and what's related to me. I'm not sure, I can't remember, I've got a blank on it. Yeah. Would anybody else find that useful? Do you feel a need to do it again? Or are you happy with it? Okay, no, it's not a common feeling. Okay, let's just have a look as a group feeling. Because one thing that I wanted to share with you, that I when I went through the papers that we did yesterday, I found it very interesting in the sense that, I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel I'm the only one that's got this problem. You know, all these other guys are such nice devotees, you know. And, you know, I've just got so much demon in me, you know. But then it was very illuminating for me that when I looked at these papers from yesterday, in essence, we all seem to have very similar three that are the main problem, you know. So it would seem a shame then for us not to be more open in discussing our weaknesses, put less strength, less force behind discussing our strengths, and be sharing our weaknesses. Because if we anyway have the same ones, maybe we can help each other overcome them. But let's just have a look here. Willfully, how many people got more than 10 in this section? Just so you're not too bad. 50% over the hill. How many of you got more than 5? How many of you got more than between 1 and 5? Okay, so majority between 1 and 5. Okay. What about whimsically? How many got over 10 for this one? Okay, that's an honest look at the situation. How many of you got between 5 and 10? Okay, so most of us are between 5 and 10. How many got over 10 for this one? Hi ho, I'm coming to your ashram, Nori. Especially as a temple president's wife, right? Okay, how many got between 5 and 10 on this one? Okay, so it looks like about between 5 and 10 here. How many got over 10 on this one? Between 5 and 10? Between 1 and 5? Yeah, the subtleties of the mind. That's true. But that kind of fine tuning, that fine examination of things is something you have to do yourself. You really have to come to some. But that's interesting. So it doesn't look like any of us are really nasty demoniac types. You know, we're sort of not too heavy on this side, which is nice. But it does show that, and we are actually striving. We are striving. 15 out of 20, around 15 out of 20 for this is pretty good. And this shows that we are still in the stage of anasana vritti. We haven't jumped that major hurdle yet. So then if we want to get serious about doing this, one nice exercise to do, especially in months like Kartik, is to read through the 64 items daily. Because when you have an awareness of something, you're more likely to follow it, to make a conscious decision about what you're doing. It's just a little exercise. It may not be as exciting as some of the others I know people are doing, but it's very, very practical. You know, it's helpful. Because at this point, this is obviously, we're looking at the beginning stages of Madhyam. We're looking at the beginning stages of Madhyam. So to bring us, rather than to come back down, fall back down into Kanistha, if we want to leave the Kanistha Madhyam platform and come into the Madhyam, Uttam Madhyam, then we have to start doing things very consciously and with attention. So then it means, one, we have to know the Shastric injunctions, remind ourselves of the Shastric injunctions, and then, even if it's a little bit tough at first, to create a taste for following them by getting ourselves in the habit, first of all, of just following. It may not be the taste at first, but it's like with most acquired tastes. You may like not like something at first, but then with time, it'll start to become part of your nature. Especially if you are don't do things mechanically. For example, when you're doing the parikram of the temple, that can be a very, very wonderful manasa exercise in terms of the relationship with the deities, pastimes of the deities, so many things. So don't limit yourself to just, you know, seeing rule, regulation like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem. The two ways you can do that. One is to pay your obeisances to one tree early morning. This is the way I do it because I'm not a terribly conscious person. I just pay my obeisances to one tree on behalf of all the trees. And the other way you can do it is to mentally pay your respects so that your preoccupation, you may be walking at the same rate, but your preoccupation mentally is to be offering obeisances. That would be a very wonderful meditation. You probably couldn't hold it for more than 15 minutes if you're of my level of consciousness, but if you're a higher level, then you could probably do the whole parikram like that. Any thoughts on this? Any observations about yourself that you'd like to share or about the exercise? Yeah. That's a nice point. Yeah. Actually, this is the beginning of Madhyam. It's when we become aware that we are paying our obeisances, but it's more like doing our exercises, as Prabhupada would say. You know, that we just go through the motions. It's an interesting, you know, like if you go down and come up quickly, it means there's no mantra, isn't it? But part of paying your obeisances, there's such a culture involved. There's not so much discussion of culture in the movement at the moment, but it would be very valuable if there was. For example, when you pay your obeisances to the deity, it's important that the deity knows who you belong to. Because they have no interest in you independently. Who are you? Just another conditioned soul struggling along, kicking the modes, right? Not so much. I have no real interest in you. Of course I'd be merciful, they're merciful to everyone. But if you want that special relationship, you want that special mercy, they have to know who you belong to. So why does it say in the Shastra, when you pay your obeisances, you say the Guru's pranam loudly, audibly? Because the deity wants to know who you belong to. Then when you stand up, oh, you are a servant of such and such, very nice. You know? Deities are people. So, you know, when we are aware of why we do things and why the injunctions are there, it makes, you know, life a lot sweeter. It's always good to say the Guru pranams. You may have particular prayers that you like to offer at each altar. That's a different thing. That would come under reciting notable prayers or if they're your personal prayers. Yes, yeah, the Guru pranam should always be there. Always be there. Yeah. Even little things. There's so many cultural points that are there. For example, why do we pay our obeisances to the deities with our left side showing? And we pay our, and to Prabhupada also with our left side showing. But then we pay obeisances to everybody else on the planet with right. Why do we do that? You know, so even when we circumambulate places, we enter a car or a rickshaw, the proper etiquette, proper culture is to enter from the right side. Because right side is our best side, you know, we want to show our best side. So what we're dealing with, the material energy, we are offering as a sign of respect our right side. The left side is usually associated with dealing with unclean tasks and things like that. You know, when we, whatever. So, and then, but with those personalities who are not within the realm of the material energy, Prabhupada and the deities, they know us for what we are. We want their mercy, so we expose everything. We pay the left side. They know us for what we are. Accept us as we are, and please help us improve and bring us back. You know, that's very interesting, all this sort of stuff. Anyway, we better stop because the bell just rang. We just have my benefit.